Hi, y'all. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, Phil.
Oh, thank you, JC. I want to introduce this gentleman here, in case anybody in the room doesn't know who it is. Please welcome John Schofield, who's going to join us now.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, are we on?
Academic research.
Oh yeah.
Program tonight.
Before we get started, my name's JC Juanas. I work for Phil's management company, Cygnus Productions. We want to thank everybody and welcome you here for the Phil Lesh University Masterclass. And we're going to take this portion of the evening and have the Phil Lesh and John Schofield touch on improvisation, something that they both know very well in their respective musical careers. Phil Lesh, of course, exploring the boundaries with the Grateful Dead, and John Schofield really getting out there with the late Miles Davis. But I want to ask, start it off, Phil and John, can you just briefly touch on the differences in the improvisational styles of the Grateful Dead and Miles Davis, and how this thing has channeled into your getting together for this recent DVD project?
Go ahead, John. You start.
You know,
now.
I don't.
I'll chime in.
You know, the differences. I don't really think it's all that different. I mean, Miles came from from jazz, from a real the jazz music of the 40s and 50s, but by the time the 60s came around, Miles, he took jazz and invented, some people would say, jazz rock, and used funk rhythms, and the Dead were doing a similar thing.
Well, we stole it right from the jazz world.
Yeah.
We just ripped it right off and applied it to rock
well,
and roll.
Well, you know, everybody's ripping like crazy because...
Yeah, that's what musicians
that's
do.
That's what musicians do, right.
Yeah.
So I think that jazz and rock music really came together in that period. So in that way, JC, there, I don't know the difference, you know.
Yeah, well, it was like we consciously modeled our thing on Coltrane's quartet within the modal thing. I mean, this is literally, we literally lifted the whole procedure from Coltrane and Jimmy Garrison and McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones. But the thing was that when we started applying it to rock and roll, it opened up all kinds of different pathways that, it was a very short step from there to John Cage, the John Cage level of improvisation, in a sense where everything is music. Music doesn't have to be made up of notes that are played in pitch. Exactly in tune and exactly in rhythm. Music can be noisy. It can be gritty. It can have texture that goes beyond. And this is a very 20th century thing, where the dominant. I've always felt that the dominant feature of 20th century music wasn't rhythm so much as it was timbre or tone color or sound quality. That's the element that was developed most greatly in the 20th century, and so taking that and taking the whole thing of improvisation on a drone, which also our influences also included Indian classical music, North Indian classical music, which is supremely improvisatory in that they don't even have a head arrangement of a tune that they play. They have a scale, an ascending scale and a descending scale, and they make all their music from this scale, which they hold in their minds, and they play these notes off against, and all of the other details are improvised within a certain rhythmic pattern, and you can mix them up, and then there's the whole concept of tonal allegory, which is in Baroque music, is if you descend into the flat keys from wherever you are, if you go into flatter keys, that's considered an anabasis or a downward journey. And if you progress through keys into the major key area, into brighter and sharper keys, that's considered a katabasis or an ascension. So all of these things kind of melted up in the Grateful Dead. And that's and the fun thing about it was that we could try to do this on the spot, and it never had to be the same twice.
Right. And that's something that happened in jazz music as well. And there's something about the feeling of when you just say, let's just see what happens, and you're on the gig in front of people, and you don't have a safety net. You just play, and you listen to each other, and all of a sudden, on a good day, something happens. That's what happens is greater than the sum of the parts. And everybody plays together, and it's magic, and you get hooked on that. And I think that that's something that was probably always around, but has really progressed in our lifetimes, you know, and in all kinds of different kinds of music. And it's the thing about it is it doesn't always work, you know.
So
but the reward is so much greater than playing the same exact arrangement every night, you know.
No matter how well you play it. No matter how well you play it. Okay.
John, you used to live here in the West Village, and you played a lot around here. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned to me when we first met about first seeing the Grateful Dead over in Tompkins Square Park. Care to share that with us?
This was a long time ago, folks. I most of you... I grew up.
Most of you young whippersnappers weren't even born when this happened.
That's right, but Phil was old enough to play around and do gigs. I came in from the burbs where I lived in Connecticut on the train, and I heard that the Grateful Dead were playing. And Phil, this is funny because I had never saw this was Tompkins Square Park in 1968, and I had never seen so many guys with long hair. In one group, the whole park was filled with freaks.
Yeah,
and I knew what I wanted to do. That was it for
me.
I said, I want to stay right here.
These is my peeps.
Yeah, this is my peeps. And the Dead were playing, and it was a wonderful day. And the group called the Blues Project opened for you guys.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that it's come around and here we are playing together. This is great. Yeah.
How cool is that? How cool is that?
John, you were telling me.
I think so. Yeah. What?
I didn't catch that.
No.
John was telling me he's just played on the new album by McCoy Tyner.
Oh. That's true. Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, McCoy is well. Phil just mentioned the John Coltrane Quartet, and that was this incredibly influential group in jazz. And the piano player in that group was a guy named McCoy Tyner, a man, a gentleman, who's one of the senior giants live playing jazz now. And this is interesting. I don't know if you heard about this, but McCoy wanted to make a record with different guitar players. And so he used me on a track and Ron Carter and Jack DeJohnette, incredible rhythm section. And then on some other tracks he used Bela Fleck played with him on a track and Derek Trucks played with him on a track.
Yes.
And so it's really a different thing for McCoy. And it was, you know, great to play with McCoy. Yeah. I'd done that a little bit before, but...
Yeah. When did we get that, man?
That's coming out.
I want it on iTunes right now.
I'll tell you what, Phil. I'll slip you something, you know, because I got.
Thank you, John. Oh yes, it's good to have friends.
Phil, who are your influences? The major influences in regards to improvisation. I know you touched on John Coltrane, but there are several others, are there not?
Well, it's funny. Improvisation occurs on so many levels in life. It started out in music and it spread. So that most of my whole life is an improvisation at this point. Or either that or it's always been like that, and I just didn't notice it. In any case, it's just the idea of it. It was jazz music that took me, it opened that door for me. Yes, but once the Grateful Dead started doing it, and some of the potential became really a little clearer to me. It was like, it was just the idea of it. It was just so, you know, I mean, we improvise. There's a theory of consciousness that says we're improvising the entire universe right now, all of us together, simultaneously. Mm. Only we don't know it, or we've decided that we're gonna ignore all that and just enjoy being here. And so, the relationship of improvisational, collective improvisational music, to me, is like it's like a metaphor for that, and it's just, I mean, it's just so deep, mm-hmm. in so many ways. That and it connects, you know, just living in that way kind of connects you to the cosmic flow, because if you don't expect anything, or and you're willing to work with whatever is, then you're kind of in the pipeline. You know?
Yeah, and that's really important, to accept what your fellow musician plays as absolute, and yeah. You don't. You can go your own way with them, or you can go exactly with them, or you can actually go in a separate way. There are all these different streams happening at once, but you can't control it.
No,
you have to go with it, and yeah. That's a really important lesson, I think.
And it's also important to remember that nobody else is controlling it either.
Right.
It's the gestalt that is controlling it. It's the totality that's greater than the sum of the parts. And so if you're not controlling it, then you don't have to worry about you don't have to worry about whether you're going to fuck up or not.
Right, right or wrong is different.
That's right. That's right. And that's why I've always said there are no mistakes, only opportunities. Mm. Yeah. And that could be true in life as well. Although the consequences are sometimes much more severe than...
But you know, I think you're right that it's the life lesson that I've gotten from playing music with other people and working together. It turns out it's just the same thing as going out in the street, and you don't know what you're going to say when you meet this person, but you say something and then they say something else, and all of a sudden you're in a great place that you really wouldn't get to by yourself, hopefully. And the same thing with the music. So yeah, when you improvise music, it becomes kind of more than music. Yeah, it's life
and
as well.
It's definitely more than oneself, one's own ego. I thought I had a beautiful thought, and now I've lost it.
It's coming back.
No, it's out there circling. Yeah.
What was it like working with another kindred spirit this summer, Greg Osby?
Oh, that was a kick and a half. And didn't we have fun at the Warfield?
Oh, that was fantastic. I just saw that, Phil. I hadn't seen it. I just got home and saw it. Yeah.
We made a DVD of this gig. This band was only together for 2 days, two performances. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and that's kind of the reason I wanted to record it and document it. And it was quite an amazing experience.
I thought when I seeing the DVD, I was reminded and so how Greg just was waiting for the moment, you know, and he was so patient.
Yeah,
and
he was.
Because he improvised the whole night, you know. Yeah. I was learning the chords to, you know, Uncle John's Band or whatever, but he was playing the saxophone, so, you know, I had the chord charts and was learning them that way. He was just had his eyes closed and listened, but he didn't play. There was very little superfluous stuff.
No.
And then he would find this right moment. It was beautiful.
And then he was really there, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it worked later on in the tour, too.
Yeah, because he came in.
Yeah, he came in. He came in and it was just, it was really cool having to start over again and build the, you know, perceive and be a part of the musicians kind of knitting themselves together in a psychic net, as it were.
Right, because we did a tour this summer, and I did the first half, and then I had to split because I had another tour that I had previously, you know, committed to, and then Barry Sless and Greg Osby came in and
finished off the tour. So I got to do the do with two bands last summer, and that was kind of neat. Oh, thank you. JC, should we? Do you think we should throw it open to questions from the audience?
Yes.
Phil, how would you contrast the improvisation that occurred at the Grateful Dead in the various phases of the Grateful Dead's existence from the early 60s on through?
Oh, well, I can only say that I definitely hope it evolved. Yeah, and I think we hadn't really achieved the goal, and I don't think we really knew what the goal was even after 40 years. It was still hard to fight our way through what's expected, you know, and what you want to play from habit and stuff like that. So. I don't know that we ever achieve very often the ideal, which to me now is complete improvised polyphony or many voiced music, where there's every voice is playing a melodic line of some kind or a part of musical interest that contributes to, like a piece in a jigsaw puzzle, to an amazing whole. That's so jaw-droppingly intricate that no one human being could think it up by themselves. So that's been the goal for me. I mean, that's what I've developed at this point. I don't know if we ever talked about it like that in the Grateful Dead. And it happened enough times with the Grateful Dead, so I knew. And we all knew that it could happen, and it wasn't just a will-o'-the-wisp that we were chasing. But the goal really is the journey. Seriously, it's the process is the reality, and I'll never be satisfied. I know that's how most people.
Hiya, Phil. Hiya, John. Quick question is, how much on average do you play a week? It's the Iceman over here, Phil.
Oh, hello.
I was just wondering, like, how much do you play a week?
You know, I'm a lazy son of a bitch. I confess here in front of you all, I don't practice a lot. I do not practice a lot. And I'm being very remiss when I do that because, you know, sometimes I get sloppy. But, yeah. Hey, it's who I am.
How you, Phil? Hey, Phil.
Yeah. He's a bass player. If they practice too much, it's weird.
I had a question about how much
the
audience affects
Thank
the direction
goodness.
You take when you're doing improv.
Thank goodness.
That's all I have to know. Come on.
Yeah, and if they know more, it messes us up. What are we going to play?
That's frosting on the cake. You know what happens after the drums stop?
Bass solo.
Very bad when drums stop.
Hey, Phil, how much does the audience's participation or what they do take you in a different direction when you're in the middle of an improv?
Well, it's funny because are you the same guy who asked me that question last night on the radio? No, but no, it's great because it made me think about it and try to define it, because it's very subliminal. The response of the audience and how it affects the music is very subliminal. It's like it comes. It's like a handshake or a tennis match, a ping pong volley or something like that. The music goes out in waves, and the audience sends back energy in waves. But it's not; they're not simultaneous. So it's a give and take. It's a breathing in and a breathing out. And when we breathe out, you breathe in, and when you breathe out, we breathe in. It's kind of like that. And it's all on a completely subliminal, psychic level. I mean, it's not like the although in some instances back in the day, there was a huge influence that came to the band from watching the way the dancers would move in unison without even knowing it. They would make waves and patterns and spirals and stuff on the dance floor. And I'm talking now of 1966, the Trips Festival, and in that era, and that sort of thing. I mean, you could see the energy because it was manifesting in that way. And now it's not quite so visible. It's just It's the vibrations, gang. It's the vibrations. You know, I don't know how, it's a little more, because I know when I went to see you last time, John, at Yoshi's, you know, it's like a call and response thing a lot of times in church, even, mm-hmm. where the musician will play something extremely cool and somebody in the audience will say, oh!
Yeah. And you know, that's even though jazz musicians tend to be kind of cool sometimes, we are not in a vacuum. We need the audience, you know. Oh, God, and no. I can't imagine what music would be like without the people. And it's a subtle thing, you know, but it makes all the difference to have the audience with you, you know,
that's the fundamental level of music is live music performing. Before in primitive, when music first arose from the human soul, it wasn't an art form, a separate art form, mm-hmm. that was done by certain elite members of society for others, you know, performer and audience. There were no performers. Everybody did it. Mm. Everybody did. The whole tribe did it. Mm-hmm. The whole tribe made the drum music, and the whole tribe chanted, and the whole tribe danced, and it was religion.
No.
It was the religion of movement and flow, and that's still what it is, except now it's kind of you know, been built up into this whole performance thing. But a recording is like a two-dimensional black and white photograph of a 11-dimensional universe.
Mm. Yeah.
So and as brilliant and as beautiful as recordings and black and white two-dimensional photographs can be, it's like the map is not the territory. You know what I mean? So. Mm. That's why music needs people. People who need music are the most musical people of all.
That sounds like a song.
Hey, Phil.
Yes.
I'm curious about the selection process that goes into choosing friends to join you on tour and how that impacts your set lists and your rehearsal process heading into that tour.
That's like 9 questions, man. Okay. Well, you know, I'm a kind of a musical magpie or an omnivore. I kind of like to reach, you know, make large, long moves and find musicians who, you know, who don't really have a history with the Grateful Dead music or a Grateful Dead family. That's what I like to do now. I started out trying to keep it close because figuring that those people would be most in tune with the music. And it's a funny thing, when musicians who have not been part of this music before come to know it, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, there's a lot of empathy immediately that the musicians have for the repertoire.
Yeah.
And
I think it's smart of you to bring in people outside of the, you know, the people that really know the music at this point, because there are a lot of people that, you know, that could come in and do Jerry and try to do that, and that's the last thing you want.
Exactly.
Because the music, the songs are flexible enough and allow for different personalities to come to them, so that would imagine that make a lot more fun to have people that bring a fresh perspective.
Yeah, and it's good for me too, because I get to hear these songs totally reimagined.
Yeah,
you know, in a way that I couldn't have thought of myself. Jerry couldn't have thought of himself. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, but the music deserves this. All music deserves this.
Right.
It does.
Right.
It what it does not deserve or need is to be frozen in amber and played back exactly the same way every time.
And it turns out, you can't do that. No, but doesn't it turn out that you can't freeze it anyway? I mean, as hard as you try to recreate something, it's not the same as that great thing, because that great thing is that.
Let's find something ours, something some great thing that's ours.
Yeah.
That we put together, because that's what the message is.
Yeah.
That's what musicians playing together, improvising freely, and creating music in the moment on stage simultaneously. It's a metaphor for what human beings can do when they collaborate and cooperate with one another without worrying about who's going to get the credit or the money or anything. You know what I'm saying? It's almost a religious duty at this time in the history of our species and our planet for us to love one another and cooperate. So the music that we're making today is a metaphor for that. Even when it's not perfect, even when it's not like it was, even when it's not, even when there's a train wreck, you know, because that's a metaphor for real life, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Humans in any, you know, whether it's an advertising company or a taxi outfit, you know, there's always conflicts and there's always stoppages and blockages and there's always, and then there's resolutions and there's growth. And so, you know, we owe it to ourselves to take this message to heart because it's needed more than ever. Okay, I think that's my rant for tonight.
Hey, Phil. I was wondering if I've noticed you've been using your in-ear monitors to conduct the band a bit in later years. And I was wondering if you felt like that might sacrifice anything in the performance, like spontaneity.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Could you rephrase that question?
Sure. I've noticed you conducting your band when you step up to the microphone and discussing tempo and key changes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And I was wondering if you felt like that sacrificed any spontaneity as to the old days when you used to kind of sort of musically discuss it.
Well, you know, it's a question of the context and what I want to have happen. Because, you know, essentially, at least in these performances up to now, it's like my band, so I kind of want to decide, make what, you know, I kind of want to have a little control over it. But the things that I say are very broad. I'll call a key, because if you're going along in a groove and you've reached a peak, and some idea has been stated and it's sort of wound itself down and you find yourself, you know, vamping along, all you have to do is change the key and something will happen. Some idea will surface. Sometimes we're able to do it spontaneously. Someone will play a note that's not quite in the key that we're in, and I frequently like to do this. I will play a note that makes that note part of a specific other key, and it works like a charm. And then the rest of the band kind of falls in, and we're in a new key, and it's sort of oozed in there, and it's very subtle. Now, other times, I like to call it in, I like to count it in at a certain specific point. Like, I want it to happen. Music happens in blocks sometimes, in large chunks, and the length of these chunks really determines kind of the emotional trajectory of it. In other words, how many bars passes before a chord change and stuff like that. So sometimes there's a specific point where I want to change the key, and it's for an emotional reason. You know, we've been here long enough, and now we want this exact new color to come in, and so I will count that in at that time. And then the only other thing I usually use that for is to start songs when we're in a jam. And we've surfed the current long enough, and now we want to make port at this island here that's coming up. So I'll call the name of that island, and we'll
We liked it when he did it. You know, I mean, it doesn't get in the way of the spontaneity, because it's just like another idea. You know, it's just like another musical idea, and we're all going with each other all the time. And when Phil says go to G, it's cool. It's just another, you know, here we go.
And in all fairness, I always try to do it with the with my instrument first.
Yeah. And if that doesn't work,
unless I don't, you know what I mean? Yeah. Unless I don't fucking feel like it.
Yeah. It's his band, that's for sure. And you know the thing. The other thing is, I know that all the sidemen, we've all, you know, been leaders and stuff, and I think that makes us better sidemen. You know, it's any of us could call the shots, and it would just
and
be another
do
thing.
In our band.
And do, you know, and often do. But then you realize that that when one person says let's go here, it's just the same as if I said let's go there. It's okay because we can go anywhere, and we all just, you know, there we go, there yeah. we go, you know.
Boom.
Let's go.
Right. There's the door. There's the road.
Yeah.
Pedal to the metal.
And it really helps. And see the technology that Phil has in his band of having the monitor just be. You know, not out in the house. This is a fairly, you know, recent development in music. So now he can, and the dad.
Yeah, Grateful
used
Dead
to,
used
know.
To do it, use it to tell jokes to one another.
Yeah.
And you hear the one about the blonde and the bombshell.
Right. I'd like to have
no, a. That's
I'd
a
like
lie.
To, did anybody ever tape what you guys were talking about?
I wish they had, man. Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to hear that.
Hi, Phil and John.
Turn me up. Turn me up. No, turn me up.
I'm up. I'd like to know. I have a serious question here. Hey, Phil and John. I have a question. Hey, I know you talked about improvisation and you talked about vibes and how they affected your life. I wanted to know if there were any times where you were playing and you thought that those decisions you made musically made a difference in those decisions in your life at the time?
Huh?
I thought when you're getting married, somehow it had to do with you.
Yes.
Both of you guys worked with John Medeski. I know, John, you've played with John, and Phil recently played with him. Phil, can you discuss working with John Medeski recently at Las Vegas?
What a trip. What a trip. That guy's all over it, I'm telling you. And we had a band with John and with Trey. And Larry Campbell and John Molo and myself, and so we played this gig at Vegas. And the cool thing about it was that John is one of those guys who he'll put some weird shit out there just for no reason at all.
Yeah.
And the thing that's really neat about it is I love that stuff. So he just kept throwing out these nuggets that I got to pounce on, you know. Yeah. And then I got mad at Trey because he pounced on one first. You know, I mean the guy is just a kaleidoscope of ideas, and it's really all the different textures, and he plays all those different instruments, and everything is absolutely so tasty and cool. I really had a great time with him.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a giant, and all those keyboards going through guitar amps, it's a different sonic thing.
That's right.
But you know, the other thing is the improvisation is, to me, is the root of, again, of his thing.
Yeah.
That he will go wherever you want to go and somewhere else again all
right.
night and every day. Yeah.
Yeah, and then or even he won't even wait for you.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Then
you get into the different levels of like, you know, it's all going on at once, just like in this room. There are all these sounds, and you're talking about that over there and this, but it all paints one big picture. It can be, and you don't have to play in unison. You don't have to, I mean, two things can exist at the same time, absolutely simultaneously, and have, in a way, nothing to do with each other, but they do.
But
you
they
know?
Do because
and then we get into Charles Ives.
Or Cage even.
Yeah.
Where you know, his famous piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which I always thought was a joke, but then I realized that it's right in line, I mean, it's right in line with the way we think about it. I mean, what's happening now is the music.
Right.
You know?
And accept everything that happens.
So everybody dig the music that's happening right now.
Hey, Phil.
I went for 2 years.
Over here,
you guys, you got to excuse me for a second. I'm getting along in my maturity here, and I have to go to the bagno. So you're going to have to excuse
me. Me too, Phil.
All right. Thank you so much, Phil. John Schofield, Phil Lesh. Let them know you love them.